Hey, super fans. This is Richard Donner, and you're listening to Comic Book Central, where comic books come to life.
Salutations, superhero fans, and welcome to Comic Book Central, where comic books come to life. I'm your host, Joe Stuber, broadcasting from my very own fortress of solitude, the Comic Book Central Lair. So glad you could join me this week. Oh man, big show in the Lair today. Amazing guest, a super guest is set to join us today. Look, you heard him right off the top. You know who's here today. If you follow Comic Book Central on social media, you've seen my Daily Planet mock-up with the headline announcing the special guest for today, the legendary director who brought us Superman the movie, Richard Donner. He's going to be along in just a few moments. Like I said, big day here at the Lair. Looking forward to Mr. Donner joining us today. If you are new to Comic Book Central, if you're just tuning in for the first time, or if you've only heard a few episodes, welcome. Glad to have you on board. If you love the Superman films, and you haven't already, you're going to want to check out my other Super Conversations well on past episodes. There's a bunch of them out there. Executive producer Ilya Salkind, he kickstarted it all, found the money, got the ball rolling on this. Kryptonian villains Non and Ursa, they were here. Jack O'Halloran and Sarah Douglas talking about menacing Superman. Superman's pal Jimmy Olsen, he was here. Mark McClure, he stopped by for a conversation. Young Clark Kent, Jeff East, he was here. And Margot Kidder's stunt woman. And Spider-Man's girlfriend, Ellen Bree, she stopped by to have a chat. If you remember, in the Superman 2 Richard Donner cut, Ellen took a header into a fruit stand into that movie. So we talked about that scene. All of those talented folks were right here in the Lair. So if you haven't heard those interviews, after today's show, head over to comicbookcentral.net. They're all there in the archive. Or better yet, subscribe to the show in iTunes. You get every episode that way. If you're in iTunes, leave a review while you're there. Always appreciated. The episodes are also on Blueberry and Stitcher. You can get them on those services. There's a complete episode guide, so you can track down where all these are in the About section on the Facebook page. You can click the link on the website or just head to facebook.com/comicbookcentralnetwork. And you also want to be sure to follow Comic Book Central on Twitter at comicbookctrl. So I post the episodes Facebook and Twitter every week, so you can catch them there. Man, Lair is everywhere, so go out and check them out. A lot of Superman talk on tap for today. But first, we need to start off with, unfortunately, some sad news in the world of Superman. Bob Holliday, as you might recall, played the Man of Steel on Broadway in the 1960s. He passed away Friday at the age of 84, so it was sad to hear that. Condolences to his family, friends, and fans. Bob Holliday, he took the stage as Clark Kent and Superman in the 1966 musical It's a Bird, It's a Plane, It's Superman. Man, 140 performances, over 140 performances, singing, swinging around. Yeah, he was attached to wires. They flew him around the stage. He was singing while he was doing it back in the day. Now, look, you longtime listeners of Comic Book Central, you might recall that I did reach out to Mr. Holliday a few years ago to see if he might be up for an interview on Comic Book Central. Unfortunately, because of health issues, he wasn't up to phone interviews. But he did pass along his thoughts to me in an email at the time. I read it on the show at the time. Good to revisit that, to remember Bob Holliday. This was his message to all of his fans out there. He says, "To all of my fans, if you saw me on Broadway, thank you for being there. If you never saw me, but you heard me on the Superman cast album, thanks for the listen. If I met you in Metropolis, Illinois for the annual Superman celebration, what a thrill. For everyone, I appreciate beyond words that you remember me. I loved my time as Superman, and I'm grateful to you all." Now, not only do we remember him, man, we are so grateful to Bob Holliday for keeping Superman flying in the 1960s. At one point, I was reading on his website that when Christopher Reeve had mentioned that he felt like he was the caretaker for Superman during his time, Bob Holliday echoed those words as well. About being the caretaker for Superman during his time. So, and performances like Mr. Holliday's were an essential part of keeping that character of Superman in the mind of the public. And that all led directly into the movie that we're going to be discussing today, 1978's Superman the movie. I mean, think about the history of those decades. You're coming out of the era of the 1950s with the television series and George Reeves. We had the Broadway show in the 1960s, which was written by two of the writers who eventually worked on the script for Superman the movie. That Broadway show was adapted into a TV special in 1975, you Comic Book Central listeners know all about that. David Wilson, Leslie Ann Warren, they were Clark Kent and Lois Lane. They were on my show here, episode 130 of Comic Book Central. In that interview, we talked about the conversations they had with Richard Donner about Superman and Lois Lane when they were going in for the parts. So roles that eventually went to Christopher Reeve and Margot Kidder in the film. So all of these actors, all of these talented folks, and especially the actors that played Superman, George Reeves, Bob Holliday, David Wilson, Christopher Reeve, all the way through up to today, Henry Cavill, custodians of the character. They're all part of the history of Superman, and they're a big part of why we love that character so much. So today, man, talk about the history of Superman. We are going to meet up with a man who made sure we all believed Christopher Reeve was flying up there on the silver screen. To me, and I'm sure many of you as well, Superman the movie remains the gold standard for comic book movies. Let's get a little background on my guest today, as well as that landmark film. Then I'm going to be back to sit down with the one, the only, Richard Donner. Richard Donald Schwartzberg was born in the Bronx in 1930. He attended schools in New York and New Jersey. He did a stint in the Navy, and he worked for his father in the furniture business. But showbiz was in his blood. Morphing his middle name, he became Richard Donner, and he set out to be an actor. And some early career advice sent him on a different path, and over the period of a decade and a half, he directed episodes of some of the most iconic series in television history. Wanted, Dead or Alive with Steve McQueen, The Rifleman, The Man from U.N.C.L.E., Perry Mason, Gilligan's Island, Get Smart, The Wild Wild West, and six episodes of The Twilight Zone, including the classic terrifying tale Nightmare at 20,000 Feet, starring William Shatner. Along the way, Donner directed several feature films, most notably Salt and Pepper with Sammy Davis Jr. and Peter Lawford. But in 1976, he turned the $3 million budgeted film The Omen, starring Gregory Peck, into a $60 million blockbuster. And that got the attention of Hollywood. When original Superman director Guy Hamilton told producers Alexander and Ilya Salkind that he could not shoot the film in England, the offer went to Donner, who was in an unusual place when he took the call. He was in his bathroom. From such a strange starting point to the worldwide super phenomenon, the story of the making of Superman the movie could make for an incredible movie itself. Guiding Donner and his company through it all was his mandate from the very beginning, verisimilitude. Donner demanded realism. He demanded believability. He knew that was the key to bringing the comic book myth of Superman to the screen. He brought in brilliant screenwriter Tom Mankiewicz to rewrite the supersized, semi-silly script, and he built on the all-star casting of Marlon Brando and Gene Hackman by defying conventional wisdom of casting a star as Superman, and he searched for an unknown. Turns out he found the real Superman, Christopher Reeve. 2 years, 11 separate film units, filming in England, New York City, New Mexico, Canada, all over the place, shooting two movies at the same time. Man, it was uncharted territory in cinema history. But the schedule and the scope of the films took a toll. Trouble was brewing on the set between director and producers. Through it all, Donner got the first film in the can and most of the sequel as well. Superman the movie premiered in December 1978, opening with a shot of Action Comics and John Williams' incredible score. And audiences worldwide believed a man could fly. As cast and crew geared up to finish off Superman II for a release the following year, Donner got word that he wasn't coming back to helm the super sequel. The producers were going with their Three and Four Musketeers director, Richard Lester. They dumped Brando's scenes, Lester reshot most of Donner's work, and the Superman film franchise moved on. And so did Donner, who went on to become one of the most successful directors in history, with films like The Goonies, Radio Flyer, Lady Hawk, Scrooged, and six films with Mel Gibson, including the Lethal Weapon series. But Donner is never far from the world of superheroes. His wife, Lauren Shuler Donner, is the producer of the multi-billion-dollar grossing X-Men film series, soon to be a television series. And in 2006, he teamed up with his former assistant, and current president and chief creative officer at DC Comics, Geoff Johns, on several Superman comic book tales. That same year, producer-editor Michael Thal worked with Donner and Mankiewicz to help the duo come full circle on Superman with the release of Superman II, the Richard Donner cut, incorporating footage long thought to be lost and restoring Marlon Brando's scenes as Jor-El. Well, time to welcome in the legendary director who scared the wits out of William Shatner at 20,000 feet, and he made Superman soar even higher. It is my honor to welcome in Richard Donner. Mr. Donner, thank you so much for joining me today on Comic Book Central.
It's a pleasure, and I admire your good taste.
Thank you so much. I know your friends call you Dick. I know you told me off mic to call you Dick. It just feels so weird to do that. I mean, look, I've lived with this film. All of us have lived with this film for so long. So it's, if I slip into Mr. Donner, please forgive me.
Dick. My name is...
All right, before we get to anything else, my listeners would absolutely have this in the back of their minds the entire interview, so I'm just going to ask it right up front. What is the latest on Goonies 2?
You know, we have tried so hard for so many years with so many writers and ourselves to come up with a sequel. But honestly, whether it's our ego or what the fans are demanding, and rightly so, everything we've done so far, and I mean everything, it just ends up like, why are we doing this? We're hurting a wonderful legacy. We're destroying a story. So we try and we look and we come up with some bizarre ideas. And you know, who knows? It may come about. It may be just that one spark that hits us. We are in the process of developing I want to say Broadway show, but it's not. It's a show in New York City where it's called, as you probably know about, immersion theater, where you become, there is no proscenium arch, there's no seats. You go in and become part of the experience of the play. And so we have a wonderful book written. We're in the process of trying to find a venue in New York. It's tough, but we're hopefully we'll get that together this new year. We need something this year that will be light and fun and interesting and make us forget about Washington.
I'm sure you'll have many opinions on that as we go through the interview. Are you interested in a Goonies sequel or reboot? Is this a true sequel to the original?
Well, all of the above. I mean, a sequel, of course, the guys they're all 30 years older. So can you use them? Yes, in my mind, you can. They could be part of a story, which would... it's open to any bit of insanity we can come up with. You can't do it like a sane man, or it's boring.
Okay, so you'd have the original actors coming in, and maybe like they're kind of like bringing on the next generation of Goonies.
That's a good idea. Yes, exactly.
I'll only take an executive producer credit on it. Lethal Weapon 5.
Yes, that's a good idea.
Is the TV series kind of putting an end to that talk, or is that still something on that could happen?
I don't think so. There's a major want to see. It would have been a wonderful thing to do. We had a great story. Really a good story. But... Warner Brothers just said no, they didn't want to do it. And okay. It's insane. Yes, there is a massive following. But that's showbiz.
Have you seen the TV series?
Yes, I like it. I love that new young actor. I don't even know his name. Okay. I love them both. Actually, they're both interesting. I like it. I mean, is that the way I would have done it? No. Did I see it and enjoy it? Sure as hell did.
Maybe direct an episode of it. That might be kind of cool.
Oh, thank you. No.
All right. Let's fly around the Earth at super speed a little bit. We're going to go back in time. You were a Superman fan from the very beginning, right? When you were a little kid, right?
Right. I would be very rich today if my mother hadn't thrown out all my comic books.
That was my very next question. I read that in your book. I read that in your biography. Oh, that pains me. I've heard it from so many different actors and people I talk to. That's painful. She just threw it. Did you have Action Comics number one? Because you were 8 when that hit newsstands.
I'm sure I did. I mean, you know, I had everything. I would barter, beg, and steal. And my collections were phenomenal.
Were you into the radio show? Were you into the movie serials with Kirk Allen?
Oh. I mean, the TV was wonderful. The movie, the shorts in the theaters when you went. There was always a short. It was either Hopalong Cassidy getting out of the canyon or it was Superman flying on a board.
And that's actually, the serials are kind of how you approach the movie, right? Let's leave them hanging for a year and then and bring them back and show how we got out of this?
Well, that's interesting. I'll tell you, originally, when we got involved in this, and I say we, it was Tom Mankiewicz, a wonderful writer I brought on, who really is, as far as I'm concerned, responsible for the success and the screenplay. He has since passed away at a young age, and it's terrible because he was a great person. But Tom, between the two of us, we had like 3 or 4 movies in our minds. And what we were going to do is, the next one I was going to do, and then after that, Tom was going to direct it, because as you know, he's directed film, and he had series and everything else. We had this wonderful thing going, and then but the Salkons decided they didn't need us because they were successful.
What was it about that character of Superman that was so appealing to you at that age? Eight-year-old little Richard Donner, and then listen to the radio shows and all that?
I would lie if I gave you an answer to that, because all of that was, along with a whole bunch of other characters and stories, was just fascinating entertainment to a young kid that kept you on the edge of your seat, and that's a long time ago.
Okay.
Boy, is it a long time ago.
Directing, we know you for directing. All the pictures you've directed, my goodness, you know, the Lethal Weapon franchise we talked about, Lady Hawk, all these different, the Superman. But acting first, what got you into acting and then into directing?
Well, what got me into acting, or the desire to be an actor, was when I was young, we had a farm upstate New York, and there was a Summit Theater. Reginald Goody's Provincetown Players. He was an old Shakespearean. And I got a job there. And the job was parking cars, cleaning the theater, and eventually, when an actor got sick and nobody was there to replace him, read his lines. That's a quote. And once I read the lines, I realized, wow, this is very exciting. I can do something with this. And I got the book. And then if you read my book, then you realize, you know, the story that happened with Martin Rick, probably one of the great directors that ever lived. And I had an assistant floor manager job and a one-liner, or was it two lines or less, was called in those days Television Authority, TBA. It was before SAG and everything took over TV. And I had one small line, like, the Indians went that way. That wasn't a line, but I chose to do it differently than I did it in rehearsal. And Marty Ritt, who everybody worshipped, came down from heaven, which was the director's booth at 8H at NBC, and came to me and said, "What is your problem? You've rehearsed it doing this way, you do this?" And I said, "I don't know. I just thought this was a better way of doing it at this point." And he looked at me and he said, "Your problem is you can't take direction. You want to be a director." And I said, "Easier said than done." And he said, "You're my assistant on the next show. Would you like that?" And I said, "Are you?" And that was it. Never went back.
What would director Richard Donner say to actor Richard Donner?
What would I say? "Oh, boy, you're terrific. Why aren't you doing more?"
I have a hard time believing that.
Isn't that true?
I have a very hard time believing that. He might say, "How do you think we should play the scene, maybe, right?"
Well, I mean, it all depends. everything is different.
Depends on how much time director Richard Donner has to shoot, right?
Well, you know, in TV you had no time. And in features you did have time. And sometimes the time allotted you became indulged. Because I love instinct. And when you start to show some sort of an insecurity or whatever, and you start to analyze your instincts, you're starting to function analytically rather than instinctively. And I've always tried to get actors to bring it to life in their approach. I would usually do things like shoot a scene. And that scene we had rehearsed, talked about, worked it through. Still tried not to destroy it by over-intellectualizing it and overthinking it, over-talking it. And then after you had it, and it was good, I'd often say, anybody got any thoughts? And invariably, if you had good actors, somebody would say, hey, you know, what about? And that would provoke another actor. And then all of a sudden, you'd have a different approach, and you'd start to work with that. And I always felt that was bringing out the best in what you could get from an actor.
That's the feedback I got from the actors that have worked for you.
Oh, really? Oh, you spoke? Uh-oh.
Well, yeah. Jack O'Halloran, Jeff East, Mark McClure. Sarah Douglas. They said to an actor that's what you did. I think Jack O'Halloran even said, Donner, let us find stuff on the set.
Yeah, I do remember a little bit with Jack. This was tough. He had a lot of grunting, and yet he had all this internal stuff he wanted to bring out as an actor. And I thought he did a super job. Super, that's a good word.
He stumbled on it. How good at taking direction was Shatner?
Shatner, let's see. Well, we were all young. And it's not a case of taking direction. It's a case of like being provoked or moved along or spiced up or loosened up. On rare occasions did you ever give direction. If you're surrounded by good actors, you didn't need to. You just had to use the word direct them and direct the flow and the interplay. And don't forget, actors were playing a character, and the only way 99% of them saw that play was through the eyes of the actor they were playing, the character. And therefore, you had at least 2, 4, 6, 8 people that were doing something and all seeing it differently. And so how do you bring all those thoughts and emotions together? And that's what directing is. You get the best of the actor by allowing him or he or she or it or they to do what they have inside instinctively, and you want that. And then you got to, because you have so many points of views, you got to focus them and bring them all together in the direction that you want for the end result of the piece of material you're making.
Well, you certainly did that in Boy Better Than Most and Superman the Movie, 1978. When was the last time you saw the film?
1978? No, I don't know.
Oh, I love talking to you. You're fun.
I don't know when. It's been quite a few years.
It's on every 10 minutes. You flip around, you catch it. I mean, Margot Kidder's admitted to, like, she sees it. If nobody's around, she'll watch it. Just, you know, but... it's not on in the Donner household? Yeah, if it's flipping around, you watching it?
Well, it's late at night, you just smoked a doobie, and you're hopping from place to place, and all of a sudden... there's this familiar face saying, hey, I did that. And it turns out to be a movie. And one of them is, on an occasion, it has been Superman. And I would sit and watch and become my biggest fan.
Yeah, I read your book. That's apparently how you shot the film, too. That's how you got through, you got through two movies at one time.
Yeah, oh, God. Don't even. Okay. That was an experience.
Okay, you could have okay, I love the story. Most know it. You're in the John, and you get the call.
Sunday morning.
Okay. And you're jotting down on a... Do you still have the little business card you jotted down the...
I have it framed.
I love it. I love it. All the information. It was $1 million, Brando. What's all on the card?
$1 million, Brando, and I forget the dates that he was available.
Yeah.
Gene Hackman, the monies that were paid, and all I saw was $1 million.
Okay, because you're following up The Omen with this. You probably could have scored a pretty big payday, though, if you'd taken the sequel to The Omen. Was that even a factor, or once you heard the name Brando and $1 million, you're in?
No, once I heard Superman.
Mm.
You know, when that call, I was really going to ignore that call. The guy, Salkind, said, and I'll send this material over, and it arrived quite shortly. And I was just kind of playing around with them because it didn't sound like anything that at that point in my career, which was just out of TV and one movie behind me of any importance, that I wanted to, they said, go to England again. And I just bought a house. And it was a lark. But then I read it. All 7,833.
It was a big script.
For me, they were f***ing over Superman. This was my history as a childhood. This was my Americana.
This was the original script by Puzo and then had kind of been rewritten.
No. The original story was by Puzo.
Right.
And then...
Then the Newmans.
Three writers.
Yeah, the Newmans.
The Newmans. Bob Benton. Had read one. And they, you know, they're certainly great writers, but they were given a different approach by, I assume, the director or the producers on what they wanted. And it was a parody on a parody.
Yeah, I talked about this with Ilya Salkind. I talked about the different scenes. Like, there's a Kojak's in it, Telly Savalas, and he comes down and he's like, "Who loves your baby?" You know, and
handed him a lollipop.
Yeah, yeah. And Lex Luthor's eating tissues. And Ilya Salkind swore up and down to me. He says, "That was never going to make it into the picture. It was always coming out."
If it was always coming out, why didn't they take it out before they sent it? You know. But that's not... It's not the incident itself.
Yeah.
It's the attitude. Just that they would have that added, that sacrilegious approach to... That sense of reality for the film would have destroyed it in my mind.
The tone.
And
yeah.
So I it was really Tom accepted on the basis that we both did that we our mission was to save part of our heritage as kids. And so we did it kind of to defend it. No idea how big this was going to be and what I was stepping into. Man, make a man fly or have those sets or the cast and shoot for a year and travel all over. And that's, oh my God, if I ever really saw that on paper in front of me, I never would have done it.
And to your credit, you were told that a lot of that stuff had already been done, so kind of the nuts and bolts stuff.
They told me that they had been preparing for well over a year.
Yeah.
And they had the flying down, they had the effects, they had everything down, and it was in great shape. And when I saw it, it was abysmal. It was terrible. It was childlike. I don't blame the Salkinds. I think that they were in it to make the movie and to make some big bucks out of it. And I don't think they... looked at it for the potential that it had and for the future. But I will say that Ilya Salkind is the one that got his father to buy the material. He believed in it. But I don't think they believed. I think they really thought that they could make a lot of money on it. And I assume they did. Point is, they used to say to me, you're going over budget. I would say, show me the budget. I shot a movie and never once saw the budget.
Was that your problem with Spengler, the producer? Was that the key? It was all of them.
It was their approach to movie making. Their movie making was, we have X numbers of dollars, and here's what we want to make profit out of it, and the rest of it you can make a movie with. And my feeling was they brought me on to do something, and then they've got Warner Brothers involved, and they realized, I mean, I conveyed to Warner Brothers that how much I needed their backing if they were going to have a picture of any consequence. And they would, fantastic, back me to the hill.
Because that was the question I asked Ilya Salkin. I asked him point blank if you were indeed asked to come back to Direct 2. And he said you were asked to come back to Direct 2. It was sort of the Pierre Spengler kind of thing. Was a huge tie-up.
No. Here's the thing. I banned them from the set. I banned them, everybody, because I found they were being totally counterproductive in the making of the movie. I would have production meetings, and we would decide on something, and then I would get to the thing that we decided on a week later, and it wasn't there. And I said, what happened? They said, the producer stopped it. So, so I just cut myself off from them.
Yeah.
When the picture was over, and I figured I'm going to be living in England again for another year, because it was a long drive, I even had gone to a little Ford dealer here in Los Angeles and designed a little van, you know, a little Ford van, with kind of a bed and a couch and an office that I was going to ship over there, because then I could, it was an hour drive, sometimes 2 hours. And then I even had the first phone that you could, anyway, the point is I was ready to go back and do it. And I got a call from my lawyer who said, or my agent, Steve Roth, he said he got a telegram from the Salkinds that my services would no longer be needed. So.
Yeah, 40 years later, that's still mind-blowing to me. I want to play a little stream of consciousness with you about your cast and crew, if you're okay with that.
Try.
First thing that pops into your head, Marlon Brando.
Actor? Is he an actor? Actor.
He's one of the best.
First thing that pops into your head. Marlon Brando, delightful.
Bagel?
Charming. Bagel. Green suitcase. Bagel. No, first thing that pops into my head is Marlon. I'm sorry he died so young.
Yeah.
He was a wonderful character. Very interesting person. A delight to be in his company. Of course, he was an extraordinary talent.
You met with him after all this, right? I mean, like, the movie's out, it's going gangbusters, and then they decide not to bring him back, they decide not to bring you back. You met with him at that point, right?
Oh, yes, many times.
What'd he think of all that mess?
He just was, the only thing that upset him was that he didn't go back to get some more money. That was Marlon. I mean, he certainly wasn't making that as a classic piece of history. He had no idea what it was going to turn out to be.
Yeah.
But that was Marlon. He was not hesitant to say why he was there, and he was there because they gave him money. But he was a delightful person to spend any time with. And whatever time I could, I did.
Gene Hackman.
One of the greats. You know, he did a movie called Scarecrow, or something like that, where he I'll never forget, it was before, way back, and there was a scene in it in the bar where he dances a striptease. It was hysterical. It was brilliant. It was Gene Hackman. Marlon was a delight to work with. Gene Hackman was a delight to call a friend. He was just an amazing individual. So sorry he retired early. But he is retired, and I assume nobody can get to him. I can't get to him. I've tried. I did so want to see him or touch base with him over the years because I admire him so and I like him as a person, as a friend. But he's chosen a monastic life of some sort, and I can't get to him. But when I think of Gene Hackman, great friend. Actor stands for itself. You know it.
You wanted him to shave his head, right?
for that story. Yeah, that was a great story.
Did you ask him to shave his head?
Well, he was represented by a publicist named Richard Gutman. And I had come back to the States while I was preparing, and I think I was shooting with Brando. And I had to come back to the States for something. And I got a call from Gutman, his publicist, and he said, "Dick, Gene's going to be in my office in an hour. Would you like to meet?" I said, "Oh, hell yeah." So we at least say hello and find out a little bit about Ajita. So anyway, I went over there, and at that time, I happened to be growing a mustache. And I went over, and he was very cold, kind of like I was the adversary. But we met, and we talked for a few moments, and a couple of things I talked about, and I said, one of the things, Gene, is Lex Luthor is bald. He said, "I'm not." I said, "But, you know, you're not going to want to wear a skull cap for the whole run. Would you like to shave your head so it'll make it easier?" And he said, "I'm not going to wear a skull cap, and I'm not going to shave my head." I said, "But you're Lex Luthor. That's your problem." He said, "Work it out.
You're the director. You figure it out."
Yeah. Yeah, that's my book.
Mm-hmm.
So that's happened a lot in my life. So I said, "Well, at least you'll take off the mustache." And he looked at me and said, "No, the mustache stays." And I said, "Oh, fuck. I got a problem here." But I figured we'd work it all out. I got to England, started more of my preparation there, and then Hackman arrived, and I said, "Has Hackman arrived?" And he said, "Well, they called us, and he has. He was in makeup." So I called the makeup man, and I said, "Does he have his mustache?" He said, "Yeah." I said, "Come on down here right away and bring your kit." So he came down, because I had shaved mine off. I got bored with it. So I said, "Bring your kit." So he came down, and I said, "I want you to put a mustache on me and make it the best you've ever done. Just put one on. I don't want to see any lace or glue." "All right." And Stuart Freeborn, wonderful man, just recently passed away. So anyway, he put the mustache on. I go up to makeup. Gene is in the chair. And I said, "So, Gene, we worked out this hair thing. As you know, that we'll pretend that Lex Luthor keeps wearing wigs, and therefore it could be your hair. We'll just style it different for each time. And then only once at the very end, when you're brought to prison for this one, will you have a ball cap?" He said, "Okay." And he was in good spirits. I said, "Hey, but the mustache, you got to get rid of it." He said, "No, no." I said, "Come on, Gene, it's really the character." I showed him pictures. He said, "No, I like it." I said, "Well, I like mine too, but if you take yours off, I'll take mine off." So he looked at me. He said, "Okay, take yours off." I said, "Well, go ahead. You're in the chair. Stuart, take his off." Stuart started to take, and he cut off Gene's mustache. And then Gene said, "Okay, it's your turn." I said, "Okay." And I just peeled it off. He looked at me, and his neck went from size 17 to 19, and it throbbed, and I knew he was going to kill me. And instead, he turned, he put a big smile, and he said, "I owe you one." And he became just this great guy to work with.
You had him.
And
you had him right
there. It all worked.
Margot Kidder.
Ah, dear, sweet, wonderful, special Margot. I'll tell you a quick story about Margot. It's in my book. Everything's in the book, because I've been through all this. But when Margot studio again was trying, you know, that when we were looking for a Superman, they were trying to get big names, and we had two of the biggest names in the business. We certainly didn't need, and as I said, it's implausible to see Robert Redford flying in tights. We never would have believed it. And with Margot, it was the same thing. They wanted a lot of big names, and so we met, and then we screen tested, and nothing really happened right for me. And I was again back in the States, and the casting director, great guy.
Lynn Stallmaster.
Lynn called and said, there's an actress I'd like you to meet while you're here. I said, great, who is it? He said, Margot Kidder. I said, you know, I know her because she had done a TV series called Nichols, the Western, and I thought she stood out. Anyway, she came in to the office. God's honest truth, she came in, walked through the door, tripped and fell flat on her face. And I said, oh my God, Lois Lane just walked in.
And so you immediately hired her for Clark Kent, right?
Yeah.
Wait, I think I got it wrong there.
Yeah, she was perfect.
No.
So she came to England. We did a screen test with Chris. And it was perfect. The two of them were just great. And we started shooting. And one day, very early into the shoot, again, I'm being so redundant with this because it's in the book and it's all, I told it. But the makeup man came and said, we got a problem, Taz. What's that? He said, Margot can't wear her contact lenses because she scratched her eye. I said, well, geez, I didn't even know she wore contact lenses. He said, yeah. So I went to see her and I said, Margot, what's the problem? She said, well, I scratched my eye and I can't wear contacts. I said, well, let's do them without him. She said, no, I can't see. I said, well, don't worry. We'll be there to protect you. She said, please, I got to. I said, you can't. If you can't wear them, you can't wear them. She said, oh, okay. So she worked that first day without her contacts. And I saw a totally different person because she was blind and her eyes were wide open and she'd kind of reach out for where she was going before she got there. And it was just perfect. And I loved it, and I showed her in dailies how much I loved it, but she insisted, and I insisted, no more contact lenses. And she used to try and sneak them in, but I had to deal with everybody, that makeup and hair, let me know if they're in. And we found the character with that. It was very kind of interesting. This wonderful reporter who was wide-eyed to everything in the world, but in reality, it was just trying to stay vertical. Margot Kidder, one in a million. What a lucky guy.
Christopher Reeve.
Ah, good old Chris. He was born to play Superman. Superman was created in the mid-30s in anticipation of Chris Reeve coming along in life. And that's all I got to say about him, except very special, wonderful individual I love dearly. And we were blessed to have him.
What questions did he have for you about the characters Clark Kent and Superman?
Oh, I don't remember. We had many. When you think about it, it was Jules and Jim, the great motion picture. Because he is a guy who has feelings for a woman, who has no real feelings for him, but she has feelings for his schizophrenic character as Superman. And he had to keep this relationship separate. He had to play those two characters in instant cuts and find them from one to the other and keep up this love story and the potential of it. I called it Jules. I don't know if you remember the movie Jules and Jim,
mm-mm.
But if you haven't, get it and see it. The French picture, but it was great. It was a three-way love story. And that's just what this was. Great, great. He did a great job. Very few people said.
You mentioned in the commentary, there's this huge scene where Superman is heading toward Lex Luthor's lair. Gauntlet of fire and bullets and ice and all these different things. You mentioned in the commentary that you wanted to leave that in. Do you have any idea why that was taken out, or did somebody overrule you on that, or what was the deal?
No, I didn't want that in. It was corny. No, I remember.
But you changed your mind in the commentary because you said, why didn't we leave this in? And Mank's like, you took it out.
I don't, I mean, when I, the only thing I can remember of it is I hated it.
Okay.
There's a lot that you'd see, and you'd say, this doesn't work.
Hmm.
You were doing something that was so much bigger than life anyway. And it was manifesting itself in a very strange way. It was like those stupid monsters we had down below. It broke our verisimilitude. It broke our sense of reality. And he went through an ice thing, I think, and machine gun bullets, and I forget.
Yeah, it was a fire gauntlet and all those different things. No, I was curious because you'd mentioned that. I just didn't know if that was why that was taken out. But yeah, I can see. When was the first time you heard the Superman theme? Was it at the finished product?
John Williams?
Yeah, or did he kind of call you on the phone ahead of time and whistle it into the phone and give you an idea? Or
No. We talked and we looked and we spotted. You know, that's where you sit on a movie all over with the composer and the editor, and you go through and you say, you know, there's a piece of music I like here, or this is the temp music we have in. It works for us, and of course, we need it. Whatever. You try never to inhibit their creativity. And first time I heard that score, which was against the opening credits, was at, I forget, the recording studio. And it was John Williams, and it was the London Symphony Orchestra. And I don't hesitate to say it brought tears to our eyes. It was brilliant. It was John Williams. Again, I lucked into one in a million. That whole picture was nothing but luck.
Look, it's been well documented, everything that happened with Superman 2. But we finally got to see your vision in 2006, or at least as close as we could possibly come with Superman 2, the Donner Cut. That was a pretty emotional experience for you, wasn't it, putting that together?
Well, I don't know about emotional. It was a satisfying one. Different sort of an emotion. I attribute it all to a young director-editor, Michael Thaw, who did the cutting, who did the research, who found all the pieces, and I would go and spend time in the cutting room with him, but it was really it was his love and energy. And we had to compromise so much in that because footage didn't exist of what I'd like to have had in. But it was extraordinarily satisfying to see or have the fan base who made it all possible, because if they hadn't been so strong in petitioning Warner Brothers, I don't think they would have ever put up the money. And it felt good, but it also there was a vacuum because it was not my best foot forward. And I know there was so much more we could have put in, because when Tom and I worked together, you know, something could be written. But by the time it got to this screen, we might have improvised on it 10 times. Or come up with something different, or made it flow. So we were stuck with what we had, and Michael Floyd did a brilliant job of bringing that together.
You referenced the plan that you had with Tom Mankiewicz earlier in this interview about more stories that were coming. Even when I talked to Jack O'Halloran, he said, "Yeah, these guys were going to do 10 films, and they never got a shot."
Now we had three or four that were.
What did you want to do? What stories did you want to bring? Just in a nutshell, were there certain characters, or what did you want to do with the story? Just out of curiosity.
You know, it's a long time ago, and I would lie if I remembered.
In all fairness. Well, I'm curious as to, is that what led into the story, the comic book stories with Jeff Johns? Because Jeff Johns is kind of near and dear to your heart, isn't he?
Oh, I'm sitting here looking at a picture of him right now.
Oh.
Yeah.
Okay.
Crazy. And he has the cutest little son now, and I'm his godfather. And
oh, wow. Okay, so you guys, wow, okay, really close relationship, and cranked out some great Superman stories.
Jeff did. He'd bring me in, but it was really Jeff.
Well, what was your role in that?
Ideas. Talking the story through, being educated by a new generation, and being provoked as an older generation to any thoughts you might have. But I attribute any of its success to Jeff.
Well, there's the whole backstory with Non being lobotomized. That's why he's mute. He was actually Jor-El's mentor. Did you have any input into that, or?
That was Jeff.
Okay.
And, you know, Brainiac, when I remember Brainiac, and we would try to bring him in, even Tom and I were going to bring Brainiac in, but a different way of approaching it. And, you know, it was like, did you see Dick Tracy, the film?
Yep. Warren Beatty.
Warren Beatty, of course. Mm-hmm. And they compounded their characters. They, again, as I said, you have a limitation on what a character can be when it comes off the page of a comic book. And you have to breathe life into it. And it's got to be something of an individual and a mind of its own. And I felt they didn't do that in Dick Tracy. And that's maybe why my dealing with Jeff was so exciting, because bringing in the youth, bringing in the new minds, bringing in the younger generation, would have, if we were going to be involved in anything today, that's the only way you can do it. And I don't think they did. I think they stuck to a very aged, dogmatic Bible. And anyway, I'm not knocking the film. It probably did well. I have no idea. But I know it was a different approach than I would have taken.
I have a listener question from a friend of the show, Mark McClure. Somebody you're familiar with?
Best candy in the world. His family owned a candy company. I forget which one it was. It was a major candy company in L.A. And his family kept sending candy over every week.
I was
going to
say, do you get free stuff all the time?
I lived on his candy.
You better.
He's a wonderful little guy, wonderful character actor. And I don't see him anymore, obviously. We're in different worlds. But I assume he went on and did well.
Yes, he did, and he is an awesome guy. And he asked me, he said he would like to know what you feel is missing from the last two Superman movies and what could help fans reconnect to the Man of Steel.
What is missing from the two Superman movies?
The last two, Man of Steel and Batman v Superman.
Oh, I don't want to. It's not my place to talk about those.
I didn't ask it. Mark McClure asked. Jimmy Olsen asked.
Well, tell him I love him, but it's not my place. I mean, that was done by people with a different approach.
Did you see him?
Their sense of verisimilitude, and mine is different than theirs.
Did you see him?
Yes.
Yeah, you can tell us if you saw him. I mean, you know.
I don't want to knock anybody else.
We'll take care of that for you. Don't worry.
I can just say, I would have done them different.
You saw Superman Returns, and I think you met with Bryan Singer before he...
It's the only, the thing I loved about that was he stuck pretty much to the story. Only had a few massive incidents with the cities that fell into the water. But I liked it. I quite honestly, I do remember this, that I was unbelievably thrown when that little kid stopped the piano from sliding into people on the boat. I said, oh my God. It's the next generation. It's Superman's kid. I was totally thrown. Good job.
I felt that it gave at least a nice bookend to your era that maybe 3 and 4 didn't.
I guess so. And an introduction to the future.
You said in a recent interview that you enjoy Marvel's Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D.
I don't think I said that, because I don't think I've seen it.
You did at the time, so apparently you have stopped watching Marvel's Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. You also said that you love Netflix.
I do like Netflix. Netflix started an innovation that has changed TV the way we look at it.
Okay. You were saying that at the same time, that you like Marvel's Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D., you love Netflix. There's a lot of Marvel stuff, TV series, shows, Daredevil, Defenders, they're all on Netflix. Your lovely and talented wife, she's in the Marvel Universe. She's cranking out one X-Men film after another, which are all stellar. When are you going to direct some of this stuff?
Oh, I've done it. I've had it.
When are you going to direct some of this stuff?
I sleep until 8:30 or 9 o'clock, and then I go and take a nap. And I love it. And my whole life all I did was get up at 5 in the morning, get ready for the set, come home at 9, 10 at night, work Saturdays, and then Sundays go to the editing room. And I've had it. I just love my life. I love my wife. And I don't think there's any way possible I would ever go back. I've done it. King of the bed.
Even if there was a fan outpouring of emotion where we just wanted you to come back, maybe even direct an episode of Supergirl. They're bringing Miss Teschmacher into Supergirl, and they've got all your Fortress of Solitude looking stuff there. They've referenced the earthquake in California.
At one point, Jeff mentioned maybe, and I said, no, and he said, right.
Oh, so Jeff did ask you about that.
Yes.
And you said no.
No, I don't know. I had a great career. I love it. I help out a lot in the office here with some of the younger producers, and I like that I'm the old sage is here to speak, and they go out and do just the opposite. And it's nice hanging around. And but no, I don't wear those shoes that I can get wet anymore.
Fair enough. I had to ask the question. Just to close it out, next year Superman celebrates his 80th anniversary. Your film, your epic film, celebrates its 40th anniversary. I can't believe it's been this long. Why do you believe the character Superman has lasted so long? And why is your film still considered the gold standard?
You know, it's simple. It's simple and it's corny, but it's nothing more than truth, justice, and the American way. It's the American way. It's as long as they get a little bit back to the American way, and this is a symbol of our country. It's to me, Lex Luthor is in the White House. And truth, justice, and the American way is going to get him out.
So that means you're going to come back and direct then, right?
If I could do that one, I would.
That would be the script that would bring you back. I think we have stumbled onto something here, folks. I think we found out how to get Richard Donner back into directing superheroes. I'm telling you what, Mr. Donner, to paraphrase what you said to Marlon Brando when he rapped on Superman, you have been just wonderful.
Thank you, pal.
I thank you for your incredible work over the years. I thank you for making us believe a man can fly. Thank you for that, and thank you for joining me on the show today.
Thanks a million. Good luck.
Now, you heard us reference the biography a few times in that conversation. I'm telling you, we only scratched the surface today. Just a little bit of information. If you want to know all about Dick Donner, go get his biography. It's called You're the Director, You Figure It Out, The Life and Films of Richard Donner. It's by James Christie. Great title. By the way, that is taken from what Steve McQueen said to Donner on the set of Wanted Dead or Alive. You're the Director, You Figure It Out. That story's in there. So many other stories are in there. The Marlon Brando bagel green suitcase story, that's in there. Classic tale. Working with Bill Murray. Man, it's all in there. So I'm telling you what, somebody needs to make that book into a movie right now. It is that good. It's available from Bear Manor Media. And you know the name. I've mentioned those folks a few times here on the show. A lot of good books available from those folks out there. They also published The Bionic Book, The $6 Million Man and The Bionic Woman Reconstructed. Also, The Bionic Boss, Richard Anderson, his memoir. That's out there. Diane McBain from the Batman TV series. Richard Anderson and Diane McBain both joined me here on Comic Book Central. Her book's out there. His book's out there. Lots of great books are out there from Bear Manor Media. I'm going to put the link to their website in the show notes for this episode at my website, comicbookcentral.net. Man, I'm telling you what, go get Richard Donner's biography. It is amazing. And if you want to know everything, and I mean everything, about what went on behind the scenes of Superman, another book you're going to want to get if you don't have it already, The Making of Superman, the Movie by David Michael Petrow. It is essential reading. I've read it many times. My copy that I've had since 1978 is completely deteriorated from reading it over and over. I had to go get another copy just so I had a good copy on hand. I mentioned the author, David Michael Petrow. In Donner's biography, great story about David Michael Petro, Brando, Mankiewicz, the Salkinds at dinner. You're not going to believe it when you read it. Oh, it's, man, just go get it. It's funny. And frightening at the same time. Those two books, You're the Director, You Figured Out, The Life and Films of Richard Donner, The Making of Superman, the Movie. If you ain't got them, go get them. Highly recommended. Also, the commentary tracks for Superman the Movie and Superman II, The Richard Donner Cut, both available on DVD and Blu-ray. Like I said, we can only scratch the surface of Superman the Movie here with Richard Donner. But those commentary tracks, Richard Donner sitting down with his screenwriter, the late, great Tom Mankiewicz, watching both films. And Tom remembers like every little detail. It's amazing. Doesn't get better than that, folks. So have a blast checking out all that stuff. As we get closer to next year's 40th anniversary of the film, the 80th anniversary of Superman, that's going to be here before you know it. So a lot of good reading and viewing and listening out there. And stay tuned to Comic Book Central. You guys and gals know this is my favorite superhero film. So I'm going to be working throughout this year on bringing in more guests from the film to the lair as well as the sequels. So stay tuned for that, working on those. But man, I'm telling you what, having the man who brought us the original, that was something special. Since launching Comic Book Central, I've been on several podcasts, several print interviews. I've been asked about this, my wish list for guests. Who do I want to have on the show that I haven't had on already? I can tell you now, he was at the top. Super thanks again to Richard Donner for hanging out in the lair with us today. That was fun. Folks, I can tell you where I will be hanging out next week. I'm going to be hanging out with my buddy Derek Cook over at Monster Kid Radio. That's right. On Derek's very next episode of his super scary, super cool podcast, we're going to be discussing the 1967 stop-motion animation classic Mad Monster Party. Yeah, it's a good one. Boris Karloff, all the classic monsters. And Phyllis Diller, she's in it too. What? Yes, Phyllis Diller is in it. It's funny. It's a great flick. We're going to be talking all about it. I always have a fun time with Derek over at Monster Kid Radio, so be sure to check out that episode February 2nd at monsterkidradio.net.
Prepare for a spine-tingling, nerve-shattering podcast featuring all your favorite monsters. You won't believe your ears when you listen to Monster Kid Radio. Hear your host, Derek M. Cook, and his ever-rotating stable of guests discuss your favorite classics and sometimes not-so-classic monster movies. Subscribe to Monster Kid Radio through iTunes or Stitcher, or visit monsterkidradio.net before the next weekly episode of Monster Kid Radio. Go through the archives for interviews with Sarah Karloff, Victoria Price, and Joel Hodgson. Listen to discussions about movies like Creature from the Black Lagoon, Island of Terror, and King Kong. And don't forget convention coverage from Monster Bash and the H.P. Lovecraft Film Festival, Classic Monsters, Modern Talk, and the Head of Rondo Hatton, only on Monster Kid Radio.
Checking out the Comic Book Central mailbag today, I had a delivery from my mailman, Virtual Willie Lumpkin. It is from listener Nicholas Sweedo. Nicholas runs the MacGyver Project blog. It's at themacgyverproject.blogspot.com. Check it out. Good stuff over there. He was a big help in lining up my interview with Stephen Kandel, writer Stephen Kandel, a few episodes ago. Nicholas wrote in about that interview. He says, "Great interview, Joe. I listened to the whole thing, and it was fun to hear Stephen Kandel talk. He is hilarious. I can't believe he's still working on projects. I figured he was long retired. Such a long, amazing career and someone who can't be interviewed enough. I was aware of his stuff at the UCLA library, and the next time I'm in LA, maybe this year, I hope to check out his MacGyver scripts." Well, thanks for writing in, Nicholas, and thanks for the assist on that. Appreciate it. Go. And by the way, folks, check out the blog. I mentioned the MacGyver Project. Nicholas interviewed Stephen Kandel about all the MacGyver episodes, so good stuff there as well. And he is referring to Stephen Kandel donating a ton of his original scripts to the UCLA library. I detailed how you can find out more about those on that episode, my interview with him. So if you haven't heard it yet, go back and check it out. He wrote Star Trek, Batman, Wonder Woman, $6 Million Man, Bionic Woman, MacGyver. Of course, he wrote MacGyver. So Hollywood history, waiting for you at UCLA. I'm waiting for you in Comic Book Central if you haven't heard it yet. So check it out. What's waiting for you online is the entire archive of Comic Book Central Conversations. That one with Stephen Kandel. The talents who brought us the Superman films. I mentioned those. over 200 celebrity guests who bring comic books to life. They are there. ComicBookCentral.net. They're in the archive. Go get them. You can stream them on the website. You can download them. Click the links on the website there to follow the show on Facebook and Twitter. There's an episode guide, as I mentioned, on the Facebook page. You can go back and check out your favorites you might have missed. Subscribe to the show on iTunes. It's the best way to get every episode. If you haven't done it already, you're going to want to do that. You won't miss an episode that way, and you won't miss the giveaways that are coming up. I got more Blu-ray giveaways starting next episode. I'm telling you, you don't want to miss anything. So go subscribe to the show in iTunes. It's free and easy to leave a review there in iTunes. That helps support the show. So if you haven't done that, if you haven't left a review in iTunes, man, what are you waiting for? You just heard from Richard Donner.
What more could anyone ask?
So go to iTunes, rave about the show, tell them how much you loved hearing from Richard Donner, give it 5 stars. I appreciate it so much when the listeners do that. And I'm telling you what, I appreciate each and every one of you out there for spending some time with Comic Book Central each and every week. I've said it before, I will say it again. Doing this would not make any sense without all of you out there tuning in, commenting on social media, sharing the lair, retweeting it, sharing it on Facebook, emailing your thoughts and guest ideas to me, joe@comicbookcentral.net, Signal Me tab on the website. You can record a voicemail at the website as well. Love hearing from all of you out there. Tell me your thoughts on the show. Man, I couldn't do it without you. I truly appreciate your support of the show. Keep it going. Share the lair on social media. Let's keep Comic Book Central Nation growing. Man, I'm telling you what, close to being downloaded in 150 countries now. That is unreal. Man, keep it up. Keep it up. Keep it growing. All right, kids, that's all the time we have today. I need to take off up, up, and away. I'm hearing reports of a helicopter and an airplane having difficulty. There's a cat stuck in a tree. I got a lot of work to go do. But just like Superman, I will return because next week on Comic Book Central, it's the return of Flashback Flash Forward February. That's right. All month long, I'm going to be channeling the Speed Force to bring you those crazy cool conversations from the world of the Flash. First up, he is the newest speedster in Central City, Kid Flash, the talented young man who brings Wally West to life on the CW hit series, The Flash. Keenan Lonsdale, he's going to be here. I know you're going to be here as well as we kick off a month-long Flash Fest and a Flash Blu-ray giveaway as well. I told you it was coming. That's the next episode. That's all coming your way next week. Until then, watch out for bald supervillains offering you great deals on land. Keep reading those comics, and thanks for joining me here in the lair. Comic Book Central, where comic books come to life. This podcast is intended for entertainment and education purposes only. All original content in this podcast is the intellectual property of Comic Book Central and is licensed under Creative Commons Attribution, Non-Commercial, No Derivations 3.0 imported license. All other content and names are registered trademarks and copyrights of the respective holders.
You know, we'd always worried during the production whether we'd succeeded in bringing Superman to life. Because making people believe that a man could fly wasn't really the hardest part of making the film. I mean, we all know that Superman can leap over tall buildings, but the question is, could he leap over the generation gap since those early Siegel and Shuster days? We wanted to know if a man from the innocent 30s could survive in the post-Watergate 70s. Well, thanks to all of you, he's doing just fine.